Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to be hosting this litigation update on the Federal Trade Commission's case against Meta. We're very pleased to welcome Slade Bond, Jennifer Huddleston, and Professor Todd Zywicki as our excellent panelists for this discussion today. And special thanks to Ashish Agarwal for moderating. Ashish is a consultant for the American Edge Project and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Ashish, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Well, Edie, thank you so much. And thank you also to the Federal Society and to the Antitrust Practice Group for helping to put this together. So in 2020, the FTC sued Meta over its acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp. The FTC alleges that Meta sought to eliminate threats to its social networking monopoly and ultimately harmed competition through increased user ad loads and decreased privacy. Meta counters that the social media market is flush with competitors and that its investments helped to expand both Instagram and WhatsApp's output. Last month, a federal court concluded a six-week trial in this case, and a decision is expected sometime this fall. The outcome could reshape U.S. merger policy as well as the social media landscape. For the first time, the government is seeking to unwind two acquisitions more than a decade old and they had reviewed and not objected to at the time. Moreover, the case has significant policy implications for free speech, particularly given the criticisms surrounding the tech sector regarding content moderation. And it also has implications for innovation and the ongoing global tech competition with China. So today we have an outstanding panel to discuss these issues. Slade Bond chairs the Public Policy Group at Kineo, Gilbert, and DeLuca. Prior to that, he served as a Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs at the Department of Justice and as Chief Counsel of the House Antitrust Subcommittee, where he led the subcommittee's investigation into competition in digital markets. Jennifer Huddleston is a senior fellow in technology policy at the Cato Institute. Her research focuses on the intersection of emerging technology, law, and the administrative state. And finally, Todd Zywicki is a professor at the Scalia Law School at George Mason and a former executive director of its Law and Economics Center. Among his many prior roles, Todd chaired the CFPB's task force on federal consumer financial law and served as the director of the Federal Trade Commission's Office of Policy Planning. So with that backdrop, let's dive right into the legal issues, and then we'll expand a little bit to talk about the policy issues. Slade, my first question is going to be for you. So as in almost any antitrust case, topic number one here is market definition. The FTC defines the product market as one for personal social networking, a definition that focuses on the connections among family and friends, but one that excludes common social media sites like YouTube, TikTok, LinkedIn, and others. What are your thoughts on the FTC's proposed market definition?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me at the Federal Society, and this is really an August panel. It's a pleasure to join you and Professors Huddleston and Zywicki, longtime commenters on these issues. And before I begin, I wanted to disclose that I don't have a client interest in this matter. I am what Meta would call an expert with an axe to grind, though, having led the Facebook portion of the digital markets investigation, where I did all the doc review relating to Facebook and found a lot of the emails that had come up during the trial. I'll have to say, sitting through the first week of trial in person was really like a time machine and going back to that doc review in 2019 and 2020. I want to take a step back to sort of set the conversation, though. I think Ashish made a really good point that this is a really pivotal case. It has lots of policy implications, and a lot hangs in the balance. And this is, to me, one of the most interesting times in antitrust, certainly in my lifetime, where there are a lot of recent decisions that are spurring really important conversations like this one, where we could see a lot of different things happen and it all sort of hangs in the balance. The reality is it's going to take a long time, but there are a lot of issues in this case that are remarkable and fascinating in their own right. And so on one end of the spectrum, we could see instead of having the Magnificent Seven, we could have, you know, the Grateful Eight in the markup if there's a breakup or multiple divestitures. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we could see, you know, a circuit split forming between these different cases that are percolating through mostly in the big tech context. But to go to Ashish's question about market definition, this is really the crux of the case, right? So it's a big fight. There's a lot going for the FTC, mostly in the form of Judge Boasberg's summary judgment opinion that really is worth reading and engaging in. It's a bit long, and he says that throughout the opinion, but it goes through all of these issues in great depth, and they certainly have been playing out in trial in even more depth. But the real tension in this case is how people use these products, right? So the FTC has alleged that Meta's model, real identities, social graphs are distinct and a different product market than TikTok and YouTube. And Meta, of course, argues that it is competing on a range of functionality as a discovery engine, something that people go to find stuff, to be entertained, to spend their time. And because that's how people are using it, it is competing with everything from iMessage to YouTube to TikTok to you name it. If it's got some type of functionality that Meta or its product share, that's going to be the market that they want to be viewed as the relevant product market. And of course, there are two ways to show monopoly power here. One is through direct effects, which Judge Boasberg did not really discuss in his summary judgment opinion because he found there was enough evidence for indirect effects, which is durable market power in a relevant market. So you're dominant in a relevant market and substantial barriers to entry. And so here, what's really playing out in this case that's so fascinating is you have white hot documents, like documents you really don't see in many antitrust cases, where you have a very sophisticated executive in Mark Zuckerberg, who I think was ahead of his time in a lot of respects in understanding how these markets tip, how they work, communicating to his leadership team in real time these really lengthy views on what he thinks is happening in the market. And separate from that, we're also seeing documents in this case from really senior people at the company who are on the growth team or the data analytics team about how they view the marketplace. So when we were doing the investigation in Congress, one of the things that stood out to me is how the director of growth, Javi Olivan, really understood tipping points in the same way that Mark understood tipping points. And they prepared information in a way that Mark Zuckerberg used and appreciated. Another example of this was Tom Cunningham's memo on end states, where he, in 2020, looked at different apps in this ecosystem from LinkedIn to YouTube to TikTok, and whether or not they were direct competitors to Facebook or Instagram or something that he called orthogonal competitors. So the point is you're seeing a richness in the litigation that you usually don't see in terms of evidentiary arguments from the FTC. And then it's coming at a really strange time where this is a case, as you mentioned, was launched in 2020. The investigation was going on before that. We had written a report in Congress, made conclusions of our own. And then 5 years later, we're seeing this play out in an economy that is, you know, admittedly different than the economy in 2019 post COVID and how people interact with social apps, et cetera. So all of these issues are playing out. The one thing I'll say as I wrap up my very long opening is when I think of these product markets, I think this is how Judge Boasberg is thinking about them as well. Just because I can get to Washington by airplane or by car does not mean that the antitrust market for an airline route overlaps with I-95. And just because I can watch a video on Facebook or Instagram and YouTube does not necessarily mean that Facebook is in the same product or the antitrust market as YouTube. And same goes for messaging and other functionality. So obviously Judge Boasberg has a really difficult decision ahead of him in terms of how he evaluates that. And there are multiple different analyses he's going to have to make in terms of whether or not they're pro-competitive justifications and scale and security and China and things that we're going to discuss on this panel today. But it all starts with market definition.
All right. Well, Jennifer and Todd, you know, Slade mentioned that this is, you know, maybe, you know, issue number one in the case. Do either of you have a reaction to the FTC's proposed market definition? Jennifer, maybe we'll start
with you. Yeah, you know, I agree that the proposed market definition is likely to be a key issue in this case. I largely disagree with the FTC's proposed market definition because I don't think it reflects the reality that consumers experience. There is, of course, the kind of extreme definition that could be put of, you know, anything that tries to grab your attention is a competitor. But I think that, you know, when you talk to your average American of name a social media app, they may name Facebook, but they may also name TikTok, or they may name Twitter, or they may name Snapchat, or any other number of apps that we think of within this market. And I think that the FTC's definition seeks to create a market so narrow that only the company Meta could have a position in it, where that's just not the reality that consumers experience. If we look at, for example, WhatsApp, there are any array of messaging apps, not only including Facebook's own messaging apps, but iMessage or Signal or Telegram. And this is a growing industry, and it's an industry that's been dynamic and changing, as I know we'll talk about later on in this panel as well, even over the course of the time of this case, where we continue to see new entrants into the social media marketplace, and where we also continue to see an evolution of what social media means and what that market actually is. Oftentimes, this kind of innovation is actually our best competition policy, and that if we only spend all of our time looking at, you know, what Facebook looks like now, we may miss what's actually going on and what the actual market that consumers experience is.
Todd, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. I think one thing that's interesting about this is it kind of points out the importance of the technical nature of how markets are defined in antitrust. I mean, I think everybody who looks at the case sees it as being a question of market definition that kind of decides the whole case. And if you ask sort of a man on the street or some random person, do you think like TikTok competes with Facebook? Like they sort of be like, yeah, I guess so, right? But that's obviously not the actual test that we have as part of a technical type test. And this is fairly well defined, and I think in a more meaningful sense, they strike me as completely different products, TikTok versus Facebook, for example. I think the other thing that's interesting about this is this is kind of this funny hybrid of a merger and a conduct case and that sort of thing. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about this case to me is when the case was really brought, like in 2020, TikTok was a blip, right? TikTok didn't really exist. And now by the time the case actually grinds through the system, you've got a different sort of structure of the market and, you know, that sort of thing. And so I think, you know, one of the questions that is raised by this case is in these cases like this, where sort of markets do evolve, we kind of have, you know, the natural instinct a lot of people have is, I think, suggested by Jennifer, well, maybe we shouldn't do anything at all. But maybe the alternative is maybe we should figure out a faster way to resolve these conduct cases. You know, we resolve merger cases pretty quickly, but maybe there's some sort of procedural type thing, so that sort of thing, so that it's not 5 years later where you're trying to kind of look back at things that happened 5 or 10 years earlier in a market that is has been changing like this over that period.
If I can just comment on that point, Ashish, one thing that Todd said that really resonated with me is this idea of, you know, how does the law actually view these markets? And the thing that Judge Boasberg has said, and that is, you know, kind of appears in the case law repeatedly, is you must have reasonable interchangeability of the products. They must actually be substitutes for one another. And so if I went down the street and asked someone, would you post your wedding photos on YouTube? They'd probably say no. If I asked them, would you look for a video on how to fix your lawnmower on Facebook? They'd probably say no. If I said, would you look for that video on YouTube? They'd probably say yes. And so when we think about what these products are actually used for, you know, I think it's really clear that there's a social graph. Like, I want to find my friend's content. I want to be connected and updated about this core group of people. And that social graph is context dependent, right? And that goes back to the point I made about the Cunningham memo. But, you know, how people interact with their social graph on LinkedIn is different than Twitter, is different than Meta. And so that's really what's going on in this case. And I totally get the point, and it's incredibly well said by Jennifer, how when you look at these products, and this is what Meta did at the trial, you can hold up a phone and they look the same depending on what you're looking at. But the reality is we have to know how the consumer uses these products when we're doing this market analysis, and that's really the thrust of what the judge is going to be looking at in this case.
Jennifer, I'd like to pick up on something that Slade said in his opening remarks, which is, the importance of, intent and how important is intent. As he mentioned, there are, contemporaneous documents in which Facebook's executives, as they're considering these acquisitions, do say things along the lines of, mobile is the future. Consumers are going to be moving to, Snapchat and WhatsApp and these kinds of platforms, which suggests that maybe taking a potential competitor off the board was part of the motivation. On the other hand, I think it's also, fairly undisputed that, Facebook Meta did invest very, very heavily in Instagram and WhatsApp, upgraded their technology and certainly helped them expand. So as we're thinking about this, kind of maybe tension between intent and investment, how should we evaluate whether these acquisitions were pro-competitive or not?
I think this is one of the difficulties in the case as well for the FTC is that the FTC will in some ways have to prove that consumers would have been better off under a counterfactual world, that these acquisitions that they initially allowed to go forward were in fact harmful to consumers or created these monopolies that shouldn't have been created by assuming certain things that would have happened with Instagram or with WhatsApp had they remained independent. And that's very difficult to understand because, of course, we don't know whether or not the product would have evolved on its own or whether or not it was only possible because of that investment that Meta made in it. It's important to remember at the time these acquisitions were made, they were not considered sure bets by the business community or by outsiders looking on. In fact, particularly the Instagram acquisition was the butt of late night jokes about how much Facebook had paid for this photo sharing app. And so it's important to think about, what could have happened or not make presumptions that we would have seen Instagram be as popular or as competitive as it is, were it not for that potential acquisition. And that will be one of the continued arguments in this case, of course. I think it's also important here to think about how this interacts in the market as a whole, going back to that market definition question. And I know we'll get into some of these questions later on, but oftentimes we also hear other frustrations about Meta brought up in the context of this case. So conversations around things like content moderation or conversations around the presence of certain types of content or concerns about the impact of social media on young people, which are all debates that we are having around tech policy in general, but are not really what antitrust and competition policy are designed for. And I think it's a particularly slippery slope if we start to see those intertwined with some of our conversations around antitrust policy.
Todd, I'd love to get your thoughts on this issue, and in particular on the point Jennifer raises about the but-for world. We're now a dozen years after the Instagram acquisition, which was 2012, WhatsApp was 2014. Is it possible? Is it overly speculative to try to predict what would have happened but for these acquisitions? Would these companies have become, independent competitors?
Yeah, I think there's sort of two ways you can think about that, right? Which is, first, you can think about it in this case. Second, you can think about what does this tell us about how we should think about antitrust enforcement and perhaps procedural changes going forward, going back to what I was saying a minute ago. Yeah, I mean, there's a difficulty here in kind of unscrambling the egg as well, right? We haven't talked about remedy yet, but as was suggested earlier, WhatsApp and Instagram are not the same, right? And it could be that the competition problem is different in one than for the other, potentially, and it could be that the remedy might be different for one than the other, simply by the difficulty of sort of disentangling and that sort of thing. And so, in that sense, it's a challenging case for the FTC, but I think in another sense, there's a long-term potential policy type question here, which is, does a case like this suggest that we need to maybe make procedural changes that get these cases resolved faster, where it's not as difficult to go back after the fact, or not as difficult to unscramble the egg or something like that, as opposed to looking back later on, so that it's not quite as difficult.
Slade, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, but I also want to introduce a very related topic, which is, the importance if...
Well, while we're waiting for Ashish to unfreeze, I think I'll react briefly. And this is a great conversation, and it's taking a lot of restraint not to dive right in at every point. I'll say a couple things. One is on anti-competitive effects and the but-for world. I think that when we look at Facebook Blue, the news feed now, we see a bloated monopoly. I think we see a company that's not really investing in product quality. I think we're seeing anti-competitive effects in the form of privacy degradation, self-harm among young people, and other things that are making the internet really a dystopian experience for parents, right? Where you have to make really hard choices between, do I want my kids to be in touch with their friends, or do I want to be worried about, addictive content behavior, et cetera. I think it's really raced to the bottom right now. To Todd's point, I think the but-for world is really hard to prove because these are different companies going back to what Kevin Systrom was trying to build in 2012. So if we almost have to become internet historians to talk about this case for the reason Todd mentioned, which is Kevin was building a beautiful experience that was not prioritized around engagement in the same way that Facebook was. And there could have been a qualitative difference had they gone their own direction. That's unknowable, but I think probable. The other debate that is existing here are the pro-competitive benefits of the acquisition, which is what Jennifer was getting at, of this idea of Instagram benefiting from the immense scale of Facebook. And this cuts both ways, right? So one, it's undeniable that was true in a sense, right? So a lot of other companies around the same time ported into Facebook's social graph and just grew astronomically. Spotify is a really good example of this. We mentioned it in the report, but the documents we reviewed from Facebook showed that Spotify having access to the ability just to sign in through the Facebook app was responsible for something like 97% of its growth. And it was like a skyrocket. On the other hand, it's easy, going back to putting our internet history hat on, in 2012, Instagram had in February, March, like 2.2 million users. They had a dozen employees. But by the time the transaction closed in August, September of that same year, they had 100 million monthly active users. They were open on Android. They solved a lot of their scale issues through hosting on AWS. And there just are like facts associated with the case that sometimes get lost in these discussions, where this was obviously a company that was competing vigorously at a time when the internet was still like kind of in play, right? So like we had mobile markets that had not yet tipped. And that also makes it difficult to, really understand what the but-for world is. But I think one question that really sticks with me is if it was competing as vigorously with these other firms as Meta claims that it is, wouldn't we see a different product experience? Wouldn't we see more innovation? Wouldn't we see more updates like we did in the 2000s, where it seemed like there was a new use case every few years? Wouldn't we see an experience where you could actually see your friends' content? That was a thing that played out in the trial, where on the eve of the trial, Facebook put a friends tab. We learned in the first week of the trial that 3/4 of users complained that they don't even see their friends' content on the platform anymore. And wouldn't you see a company that was more disciplined by the market, right? That was more interested in investing in its products rather than going on a spending spree for engineers at other companies, right? I think we would see more of that vigorous competition if the market were, as Meta has claimed that it is.
So sorry for the technical difficulties. I want to raise a related issue, which is what significance, if any, should we assign to the fact that the FTC reviewed both acquisitions at the time and raised no objections? So Judge Boasberg, in his summary judgment opinion, said basically it has no significance. These issues should be litigated fully. In a later decision in the Google ad tech case, though, the court there did suggest that if the government reviews an acquisition and raises no objections, it later will have somewhat of a higher burden in order to try to unwind that acquisition. So, Jennifer, let me start with you on this one. Should the FTC's initial reviews and decisions not to raise objections carry any significance, particularly when we're talking about kind of stability in the merger control regime?
I think they should. And I think this is one of the things that should be concerning about how this case could continue beyond just the context of this particular case, is if you start to see a real opening of the ability to look backwards on mergers and acquisitions that were previously cleared that turned out to be really good business bets, that, you know, might at the time have been very risky. Are we actually going to see something where we see companies kind of punished for taking successful risk? Are we going to see something where mergers and acquisitions become more difficult for completely legitimate and consumer beneficial reasons, where there's a chilling effect because of the cost of litigation, because of the possibility that you build a product or you build integrate a system and then it gets undone because the Federal Trade Commission considers it too successful or too powerful? And what does that mean not only in the tech sector, but beyond the tech sector? I also think this goes back to that question of, we look at these products as they are today in 2025, which I do think the market is changing in 2025. I think, you know, particularly as we look at how new generations are using different apps to communicate or using different forms of social media to connect with one another and with friends and family, and how different norms are existing around, you know, how we want to share and connect with information, that, you know, when we look, but that when we're looking at these cases, we also have to ask not what just is now in terms of the success or use rate of Instagram and WhatsApp, but what would have happened if this acquisition hadn't occurred? And do we actually see those anti-competitive or consumer harming effects? And this occurs at a time where, like I said, we still continue to see new social media apps emerge, many of which are competing with Meta, at a time where we see Meta having to continue to innovate, whether it's in the AI space or in things like Threads, to try and compete with alternative tech space social media apps, or whether it's in terms of the fact that we continue to see a lot of competition in the messaging space. So I do think the fact that these acquisitions, that we're seeing this so much later after the fact, is relevant, and it's relevant both in terms of how we should consider this challenge, as well as also what this case could mean for the broader antitrust debate.
Todd, welcome your thoughts on that. I mean, should companies be able to have some sort of reliance type interest in an initial decision from the government not to raise an objection?
I don't have strong views on that. I think it's something worth hashing out. Like I said, this is a sort of this hybrid merger conduct case, where obviously the logic of Judge Boasberg, you know, the logic that a merger is an anticipation of what will happen and conduct is actually what actually happens. There's some logic to that. I think the idea is that there may be some pragmatic reason from the antitrust agencies to be thinking through this, but I'm not sure that the law gives us a clear answer at this point, in my view, as opposed to the enforcement discretion of the agencies.
Slade, let me ask you to put your Hill hat back on here. What is sort of the right answer and the right way to think about these issues, given the passage of time?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most troubling issues about the Clean Act, is incipiency and having the ability to have a forward-looking view on markets with limited information, where merging parties always have better information than enforcers, and there's a 30-day shot clock absent a second request. And we can see two different examples of this. One is in Instagram, the email between Mark and his CFO was why there was a second request, right? That was the one where, you know, we're buying time and we're buying a competitor. You know, came up in the conversation. And then Mark, a few minutes later, realized he said something he shouldn't have and was like, I don't mean that I want to acquire Instagram to kill it. So that's why there was a second request. And I'll just characterize the closing memo at a very high level. I think the agency got it wrong at the time, right? I think that they were looking at different documents to support different conclusions. I have no idea why. But the thing that was persuasive to them was this idea that there were other firms that were sprouting up and it was a dynamic time. And I will just say that there were neighboring documents, and we characterized this in the report too, showing that Mark really understood that these markets tip, right? Like he had, to me, he was years ahead of most economists, most experts, the agencies on this exact point, on tipping points, on competition for the market. And so he understood that, you know, there could be a, you know, single firm that is going to be the dominant firm in like messaging in Europe, right, which is WhatsApp. And he understood that if you can get to that before the market tips and control it, then you can own the market, which is what, again, like he was so good at. So in terms of how this works from an antitrust perspective and the Hill, you know, agencies, of course, can reopen closed deals. This could have been a Section 7 case. It's a Section 2 case instead, which, as Todd mentioned, raises all these different issues, higher burdens of proof for the agency. But I don't think that, you know, again, like the gears of justice, the wheels of justice should take quite this long turn. I think that Todd has laid out a couple of really great legislative ideas for speeding up the process. I know that that was something that, you know, conservatives supported back when we were doing the big tech bills. There was some sense that, well, hey, why don't we just get at the process and try to speed that up? So it's definitely fruitful for investigation. But again, you know, I think that there is just some conduct at play here that really has no pro-competitive benefit to. One of the other things happening in this case is that, you know, the FTC has already lost the portion dealing with Berry of Buy or Berry. So weaponizing the social graph to harm competitive threats. And that's something that is not specific to, you know, Meta. It's something that any digital firm that is dominant has a temptation to do, which I also think is an area that's fruitful for congressional intervention down the road.
Well, thanks for that, Slade. I'd like to pivot a little bit and talk about some of the policy backdrop of this case. Now, the speech and content moderation concerns are not formally part of this case. They weren't part of Judge Boasberg's summary judgment opinion, and Chairman Ferguson has said, hey, those speech concerns really are not part of this case. Nevertheless, it definitely forms, you know, part of the backdrop really of all these cases. So, for example, when the Google ad tech decision came down recently, Attorney General Bondi came down and said, well, gee, this decision is going to prevent, you know, Google from censoring people. Not entirely obvious how that was tied up, but it's certainly part of that backdrop. So, Todd, let's start with you. How should we think about some of those speech and content moderation concerns as we're thinking about this antitrust case?
Yeah, and this is the kind of the elephant in the room, the big thing behind the scenes here, right? Which is the horrible behavior of these companies. Potentially in collusion with the government, potentially coerced by the government. I think some of it was voluntary, probably, just corporate wokeness. And their power, especially during the COVID crisis, to be able to influence a controlled debate, their power to influence the 2020 election by spiking the Hunter Biden laptop story. And what's striking about a lot of this, of course, is that they are censoring true speech. They were censoring true speech. And I know this personally because I brought a lawsuit when George Mason imposed his vaccine mandate. And YouTube censored two of my videos, which were true. Everything I said was true. They never explained why they had pulled down my videos. They're still down, last I checked. As far as I could tell, I was shadow banned on Facebook. I'm saying as far as I could tell, because there appears to be no way to actually verify or ask somebody whether you're being shadow banned or censored on Facebook. It was only because people all of a sudden couldn't see my stuff anymore, right? So I think there's, you know, clear problems here. We saw Amazon basically suppressing books that violated the government's and, you know, sort of woke corporate America's views on COVID. We saw Twitter basically yanking down doctors who are saying true information about the vaccines. Facebook had one of the most abhorrent ones in my view, which is Facebook. That was where people who were injured by the vaccines went to share their stories and look for cures and basically support groups. Facebook simply vaporized these support groups because they thought they would spread vaccine hesitancy, not even misinformation, right? And when I testified in Congress on this, the two censors in chief for the White House, Andy Slavitt and Rob Flaherty, they admitted they were not censoring misinformation. They were trying to censor anything that contradicted the government's preferred narrative and would promote vaccine hesitancy, whether it was true or not. And that's what Facebook did when it was vaporizing people's true stories and about vaccine injuries and the like. And so the real question then is this an antitrust question? And in the Supreme Court case, Murthy versus Missouri, Justice Gorsuch threw a line out there that kind of wasn't picked up. Is concentration part of the problem here? Is it easier to coerce and easier to collude to suppress information when you only have a handful of social media companies rather than a large number of social media companies? And I think the answer is true. And we see it in, for example, the correspondence between the White House and these guys. And for example, in the Facebook files, what you saw was the White House, the Biden White House, saying, why can't you be more like YouTube? YouTube's being very aggressive about censoring guys like Zawicki. Why do you have to allow people to speak on your platform rather than they were basically using YouTube as a cudgel against Facebook to get them to try to do. And so I think that's what's unique about these. This is why people get interested in this, is that this is more than just buying socks or buying hubcaps or buying, you know, whatever. This deals with information. Freedom of speech, if you go back and you look at the commercial speech doctrines, was premised on the idea that producers, suppliers, sellers should have the right to provide true information to their consumers. A consumer should have a right to secure true information. And when these guys are suppressing true information, withholding it from consumers, and instead promoting false information, which is basically everything the government said during COVID, I think that raises real speech questions. And clearly there's consumer protection issues here, but I think arguably there are also competition issues. I'll say one last thing. Yeah, even if we stipulate that in 5 years, 10 years or whatever, these things may have their ability to control speech restricted by competition, lessened by competition. But this is a serious case in which I think there are real short-term harms. It's pretty clear that the 2020 election was impacted by the decision to censor, to spike the Hunter Biden laptop story. It's hard to imagine that Amazon deciding that they were going to suppress the ability of consumers to find certain books did not influence what books would get sold in the future. If Amazon says, we're not going to allow people to find a book on topic A, somebody else who wants to write a book on topic A prime is not as likely to get a publishing deal and the like. And so I think that there are real serious questions here, which is how many elections is okay for them to influence by controlling us? How many books is okay for them to bury? How much true information that could affect people's lives and health is okay for these social media platforms to control? And I think that raises a certain element here that goes beyond the traditional consumer harm for lower prices and all that sort of stuff.
Jennifer, I want to bring you in here next. But Todd, before I do that, let me ask you kind of two related follow up questions. Does your analysis change at all, given the fact that Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg in particular, and some of the other companies have acknowledged that mistakes were made and that they did bow, probably in retrospect mistakenly so, to a lot of government pressure? And does your analysis change at all, given that the landscape has changed and that there are quite a few more outlets these days? Elon Musk purchased Twitter, obviously. The president himself launched Truth Social. Does the fact that there are now more outlets than even 5 years ago change your analysis?
Does anybody on this call really think that Mark Zuckerberg is a true change of heart? I don't think anybody credibly believes that next time Mark Zuckerberg is going to stand up to sort of pressure that he saw the last time. At least I don't. I don't trust him. I think you'd have to be pretty naive to believe that you would trust him. Yes, Elon Musk would, but Elon Musk is Elon Musk. And to your second question, I don't think eccentric billionaires being willing to buy social media companies and potentially lose billions of dollars, which is what it looked like was going to happen with Elon, is really a strategy. That doesn't seem like a strategy to me, especially when they try to do it. What looks more like what they're trying to do is described by Mark Andreessen, when the Biden White House was trying to control AI, right? When he said they called everybody and they said, we're going to allow three AI companies and we're going to control what the AI companies can do. And if they don't do it, you know, we'll figure out how to put the screws to them. And so I think more concentration is a problem. And I think that in reality, there's, unless you're Elon Musk, your Zuckerberg said basically the censorship is small fry. This is a small issue compared to all the bigger issues that we face in the world of the regulatory state. And I think finally, I think these guys might be better off. I think they'd be better off if, in many ways, if there was a law that said, we can't do this, the government can't do this, because as soon as you start doing it, you open yourself up to the shakedown racket that all the corporations saw. They put themselves basically in the middle of the culture wars. And I think a lot of these companies would be better off if they actually, I don't think most of them have the backbone to stand up to pressure from the government, we'd be better off if they had actual legal protections and said they couldn't do it.
Well, there are some bills along those lines. I believe Representative Jordan has one. Jennifer, let's bring you into this. Speech and antitrust, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I have several thoughts. And I do think, you know, in this conversation, we hear the word censorship used a lot. And I would like to point out there is a difference between government censorship and content moderation decisions that we may or may not agree with. And I understand that in the moment, it may not feel that way, but there is a big difference in terms of free speech principles. And I do think we also do need to be concerned about the type of pressure we have seen on social media platforms to take certain actions from the government, regardless of what type of government that's coming from. And one of the ways we've seen that pressure asserted is in some of the regulatory, is in the need for support from the government and some of the regulatory impact that's coming from Europe or things like that as well. So I think that that kind of needs to be separated out from this antitrust conversation. And I would also point out, though, that in some of these examples, we have to think about what this would mean offline as well. So if we're talking about Amazon's decisions to sell a book, that could very much also have First Amendment concerns and significant government intrusion into any store's decision of whether or not to sell anything. And that's something we should be concerned about calls for, in my opinion. When it actually relates to the question of antitrust and content moderation, I think that we need to look at this two ways, both of a what impact would antitrust have on content moderation decisions, and then what might our overall policy framework towards content moderation have to do with the competitiveness that we do or do not see in the market. So on the first, would antitrust actually be a tool to potentially deal with content moderation? I think it's a very ill-adept tool to deal with content moderation, not only for the concerns that this opens it up to other potential policy goals, but also for the fact that if you were to succeed in breaking up a company, say splitting off Instagram or WhatsApp from Facebook, there's no guarantee that they would actually moderate any differently, particularly when we're talking about platforms that are seeking the same type of general audience. And in fact, you might actually find that they're less willing to carry controversial opinions or ideas, but they might be even more beholden to advertisers or to retaining what they see as the core mainstream user base. So you might actually have even less of a space for certain groups to express their opinions. Additionally, you would have less resources to engage in having some of these state-of-the-art content moderation tools to deal with the type of content that we all generally agree may be lawful but awful, and that we don't want to see in our daily news feeds when we log on to social media. They may have a harder time hiring enough human content moderators or engaging in making sure that they have the best state-of-the-art tools to deal with some of the problems that arise at scale. But I think there's another element here too about how we do continue to see competition in the content moderation space and why we need to maintain a policy framework that allows companies to take different approaches. This isn't only referring to things like the fact that we've seen seen these transitions in terms of Elon Musk's approach to moderation at X and new claims around, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's new approach to content moderation at Meta, for example, that uses community notes as part of the process, but also the fact that we continue to see other types of content moderation, such as decentralized content moderation through platforms like Reddit and Blue Sky, emerging as alternatives. We also see that platforms that may be serving certain communities or certain viewpoints are emerging. And this includes not only things that have been mentioned like True Social, but also very niche platforms that may be, say, serving communities of certain faith values or things like that, that have their own content moderation rules. And having something like Section 230 enables that kind of competition in the marketplace by keeping a light touch to a regulatory approach that allows different platforms to try different styles and for users to select those platforms that best serve their preferences. And we have seen that this does at times impact what platforms users choose to stay on. How much of an impact it has remains to be seen. But I do think that we continue to see competition in the marketplace, in part because we have this policy approach that allows startups to have different approaches to content moderation, to not have to panic that someone's going to do something they didn't anticipate with their new messaging service, with their new social media service, and then they're going to be sued into oblivion, even if they're later vindicated in court. That sheer cost of litigation can be enough to prevent either investment or development of a business that therefore could create a bigger platform for speech and create more competition in this marketplace for speech.
Slade, welcome your perspective on these topics. And if you don't mind, given your background on the Hill, is there some, given what we know about what happened in the 2020 election cycle, what happened with COVID, is there a need for some sort of congressional action here?
Well, as a former Biden official on the panel, let me just start by saying I respectfully disagree with Todd on some of the points that he made. And if my former boss, David Cicilline, was here, he would say if Facebook was trying to suppress conservative speech, it was doing a really bad job of it. And he'd point to Dan Bongino having like the top videos on Facebook during that same period. But the reality is, and this goes to Jennifer's point about could antitrust be harmful for content moderation? The reality is that Zuckerberg has laid off moderators and now wants these decisions to be made by machines. So good luck to Todd if the machine decides that your speech is not, something that should came through the content moderation machine at Facebook or Instagram or wherever. That said, this is a real issue. Right. This is absolutely a real issue. It's not something that Democrats and Republicans should disagree on. And we see it in the Apple complaint. So the department filed an antitrust complaint against Apple. And it said that there's no doubt that Apple's conduct extends beyond monopoly profits and even affects the flow of speech. And they pointed to Apple being a vertically integrated TV and movie producer that may or may not have fired John Stewart for his views on antitrust. Right. I also think that there's no doubt that, monopoly power is just incompatible with the marketplace of ideas. And I agree with Todd that like the solution isn't conservatives buying their preferred social media platform. It's having frictionless speech in a way that, you can't have if we have like vertical, almost like speech ghettos for different perspectives. Like, I hate that idea. And I totally agree with Gail Slater when she said that tyranny.com isn't a lot better than tyranny.gov. And I think that if you can't reach your audience and safely communicate what it is that you're trying to communicate, that's inimical to our democracy, right? So I think there are huge problems here. Going to the 230 debate, though, I think these are just separate issues. Like I said, I think there are a lot of soft dimensions like quality that matter in this antitrust conversation. But nothing that Judge Boasberg could do could, in fact, intervene with a congressional law, so a congressionally made statute in Section 230 through the antitrust litigation. And antitrust is, or Section 230 is not a shield to antitrust scrutiny, but these are just different lanes. We encountered this exact issue during our markup of the American Innovation Choice Online Act. And over again, amendments were offered on Section 230 issues. And the point that, the chairman made over and over again is go down the hall and talk to Energy and Commerce. They have jurisdiction over this issue. We don't. So I do think there is wisdom in tightening Section 230 for sure. And we could have that panel debate too. But here, I think that the big issue really is, have we seen a monopolist abuse its power in a way that suppresses innovation, competition, all these other things, along with the marketplace of ideas. And Judge Boasberg may never get to that point, but I think it's a very real part of this conversation.
Yeah, if I
could last question.
Yeah, can I jump in? Yeah. So, I mean, I think the big question here is you first ask yourself, is this a problem? You know, and I think the answer is yes. I mean, you could say, no, it's not a problem, but I think it is. So then the question is there a solution? And now we're into the world of pragmatism. Now, in the world of the first best, Mark Zuckerberg would live up to what he's saying. I don't believe that. I don't, and I certainly don't believe that with Google in YouTube, which seems pretty darn woke to me. So in the world of the first best, they would have neutral, you know, content neutral moderation policies. But in fact, I don't trust them to do that. They have not shown that they can be trusted. None of them, except for Facebook, to the best of my knowledge, none of them have ever said what we did was wrong and we're not going to do it again. YouTube, my videos are still down at YouTube and the like. And so I have no reason to think they wouldn't do it all over again. And I will say, content moderation versus censorship. You know, when I read the Murthy versus Missouri case and the Supreme Court said, oh, this was the Facebook, this was the company's, you know, suppressing Zawicki speech. It's like, oh, I said, oh, I'm so free. I've never felt so free before to learn that it was Google that was suppressing me, not the government. I think it's a distinction without a difference in any meaningful sense along the lines of what Slade was saying, which is tyranny.com versus tyranny.gov, right? And so I think if you think there's a problem, question is there a solution? Any of the solutions now, we're in the world of the second best because the first best doesn't seem to work. Yeah, and they all have intended and unintended consequences. And so it takes prudence to take pragmatism. I think there's real unintended consequences that would come from changing Section 230, for example. And I agree with Slade, you'd have to be very careful about how you do that. But one of the problems and one of the reasons we're looking at antitrust, which is not a perfect tool for this, is unfortunately, the Supreme Court, I think, has taken some potentially viable tools off the table that might have been better things. The net choice case, for example, suggesting that common carrier regulation might not be appropriate. The ridiculous opinion of Murthy versus Missouri and this kind of, insuperable burden to try to trace a First Amendment violation to be able to bring an action there. And so now you're left with relatively limited tools to deal with what a lot of people think is a big social problem. And so, you know, to say something's not the perfect tool for the job isn't to say that there may be a way in which it can be a contribution to some sort of solution to a problem.
Pat, let me ask you, you get the final question on the speech segment here. Do you have any concern that in breaking up some of these tech companies, you might actually make it easier for the government to intimidate them? So, for example, you know, Senator Elizabeth Warren and other progressives want to do this, that. They want to break up these tech companies. Do you have any concerns you might actually empower the government by breaking up some of these companies?
In theory, yeah. I mean, again, we're it's prudential, it's pragmatic in the world of the second best. I think that is a much smaller problem than the alternative, which is that what we saw during COVID and what we saw with the 2020 election was some sort of version of collusion and coercion by the government. And it was very clear that a small number of companies that all have strong control over speech is a lot easier to control. They have a lot more at stake. There's a reason why, if Mark Andreessen is right, that there was a suggestion we should only have three AI companies rather than multiple AI companies, because then they could be controlled more by the government. So I think it's precisely this problem of concentration that Gorsuch asked about that promotes the ability to censor speech as opposed to a lot of different platforms. So I think from that, my prediction would be that, yeah, while that theoretically is possible, I think my read of the situation cuts the other way, that fewer bigger companies are more likely to be able to suppress speech than smaller companies.
Okay, let's move on to kind of the other really big policy issue that formed the backdrop of this case, which is U.S. global competitiveness, innovation, and China. And Jennifer, I'm going to direct this question to you. So, you do have, many people out there saying, look, why are we cutting off our nose to spite our face? We have, this need for hundreds of billions of dollars in investment in AI infrastructure, for example. A lot of that investment is coming from, the large tech companies. And is there a concern that if we were to, break them up or impose other drastic remedies, we might end up hurting, U.S. competitiveness, particularly with, kind of the China challenge out there? Jennifer, how should we think about these issues?
So I think one of the things to think about with antitrust is we'll never know until after the fact what we're missing out on, particularly if these companies win these cases, what they were investing their resources in terms of antitrust litigation instead of investing their resources in terms of improving their products and responding to consumer demands. We don't necessarily know what the current chilling effect is going to be in terms of what are we not seeing companies go forward and offer because they're concerned about how it might play out in this kind of antitrust environment that we're seeing. We have seen this to some degree in Europe, where we have seen companies hesitate or decide not to launch certain aspects of their products, particularly around AI. And I don't think that's something when we consider how the U.S. has been such a leader in the tech and innovation economy that we want to see right now, particularly in the global nature of this competitiveness process. There is a role for companies of all sizes in AI development. We've seen that sometimes it requires large investments and that we've seen many of the global companies that were leaders in the internet take a significant role in terms of early stage AI investment. But we also see many startups. We see a lot of venture capital. We see elements of AI development at all levels of the ecosystem where we're seeing a great deal of competition and where we don't necessarily know who those large players are going to be. Of course, right now, if we're talking about Meta specifically, Meta's Llama model is open source based, which is a bit distinct from some of the other AI models we've seen. And so it's a bit of a niche in the market ecosystem here. But I do think both that AI is relevant in terms of how it plays into this continued innovation that we see. Going back to our first question about market definition, that's probably more relevant, in my opinion, in the case involving Google. Where we did see the kind of question of is AI changing the nature of the search market come up more directly, but also in terms of the fact that we are continuing to see innovation more generally, and we can't always predict where innovation will go.
Slade, is this a legitimate concern? Not that we should treat any company like a national champion, but that if we go out of our way to break apart some of our most innovative big companies that are investing a lot in say AI, that we might end up hurting our own U.S. interests. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to align myself too much with this administration, but I will just say again, I align myself with Gail Slater when she said recently that we get innovation from competition, from companies competing against one another. And the way to win the race against China is pro-competitive, is pro-innovation. It's not, trying to hold up, again, monopolies that are really not invested in America's future. I mean, you see this with Apple. Apple traded America for China. Like, there's a book about this. It's incredibly compelling. I don't trust monopolies when it comes to U.S. interests. I just don't. And throughout the 40 years of antitrust enforcement during my lifetime, the story always is firms make this case that if you break up AT&T, Ma Bell, the Soviet Union will win, and it just does not happen. And what we get instead are lower prices and more innovation. We had fiber deployment because of the breakup of Ma Bell. That's something that Ann Bingaman testified about as the head of the antitrust division in the 90s. And we have Google and Facebook because of the Microsoft case. Like, to me, there's a direct line between these things. So that's issue one. Issue two is, what is the company that we're really talking about in this conversation that's really lurking in the antitrust case of Facebook/Meta? It's TikTok. And the innovation that we're seeing today is coming from a Chinese-owned company. That is not the sign of a healthy marketplace, right? We should have American firms coming from the Valley. Y Combinator had an event in Washington earlier this year where they're thinking of every possible solution that doesn't involve competing with monopolies. Right. We're seeing like Concorde jets for the first time again in 25 years, but we're not seeing a social media company from the United States to compete with these monopolies because there's no money in it, right? There's no one's going to fund that app. So the reality is, if we have some solution here, whether it's a combination of breakups or remedies that allow companies to really flourish and really enter these markets, I don't think we're going to see changes other than, you know, companies making a big bet entering the market because the PRC has funded them to do so and has military reasons why it wants them to do so. That to me is not a sign of success.
All right. Well, we're almost at time. So final question. Todd, we'll start with you. Predictions or other final thoughts?
Yeah, let me just say. I don't have a good prediction, but I'll just amplify Slade's question. I had a chance to chime in. I've been looking a lot. I wrote this big research paper on sort of addressing in part, why do we change antitrust policy in the 70s and 80s, right? Which had been a big debate with Lena Khan and Jonathan Cantor. And the reason was that the old antitrust policy didn't work, right? It was declining American competitiveness. It was, bad prices for consumers. But one of the things that was important about this, to come to your question, Ashish, was the global competition changed the market, right? Which is the big thing was Japanese cars in the 70s and 80s challenged the big three automakers in the United States. And what Bill Baxter and the guys back then realized was a global market is different from a domestic market in terms of what competition looks like, what entry looks like, what economies of scale look like, what competitiveness looks like. So you're absolutely right, Ashish. I think this is certainly a consideration in terms of us being able to compete with the world. I think the flip side of this relates to what Slade was just saying, which is TikTok is not Toyota, right? And when you go back to what Slade was saying earlier about the kind of crap that is being served up on the internet and the way it's marketed and the way that TikTok is manipulating kids and the like, TikTok is not Toyota. The idea of foreign competition in this context, where they're controlling speech and they're controlling these sorts of experiences, is different, right? And so maybe that does cause us to rethink how this all works. Now, I'm not saying I have an exact answer. Maybe you're right that the cost in terms of reducing our competitiveness abroad, but it also gives rise to a different sort of inquiry, I think, if we're thinking about these sorts of products coming into the United States.
Jennifer, any last thoughts, predictions?
So I think that it's important to recognize that social media remains an evolving market, and that, as we have talked about frequently on this call, these cases take a significant amount of time. By the time we reach any kind of decision, even if it's only a few months, the actual market for social media looks like may have changed, particularly at a time where we're seeing rapid advancements again and around issues like AI. I think we are in a time of quite significant innovation, and that innovation has often been our best competition policy. I also think when we're talking about these cases, particularly involving tech companies, it's important to consider the impact that these precedents could have, not only on the tech and innovation sector, but beyond it as well, particularly around the question that came up, for example, around mergers, which are not only going to apply to questions in the tech sector, but in any other numbers of areas of the economy as well. And then finally, when in the conversation around antitrust, one thing we haven't spent a lot of time on this call talking about is the impact on consumers. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about the potential impact of those remedies on consumers. And one of the things about the U.S. approach to competition policy and antitrust is that it is focused on consumers, not competitors. And to me, it's important that we don't lose sight of that in this conversation.
Slade, you get the last word.
Oh, just that I look forward to coming back and debating the remedies next month after Judge Boasberg has his liability decision. I think we can have another hour on breakups, interoperability, portability, and the range of things. My crystal ball, you know, or the Magic 8 Ball suggests that there's going to be a liability finding for the FTC. And I think that we're seeing a virtuous cycle between these different judges and these different cases, you know, try to bring antitrust into the 21st century finally. That's my optimistic take, and I'm sticking to it.
Second there, looked like Ashish froze up again.
It looks like a bro. It's great way to end the panel. Hey, I want to thank
you. You're so stunned by our brilliance that you
left speechless. I want to thank all of our panelists today. Really interesting discussion. Edie, you have a shameless solicitation for an invite to another panel from one of our speakers. I think that's great. Thanks again to the Federalist Society, and let me kick it back to you.
Yeah, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Slade, Jennifer, and Professor Zoicki for speaking with us today. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you so much, Ashish, for moderating. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.